Welcome to the Whiteness at Work podcast by Equitable Coaching. This podcast unpacks the concept of whiteness to make space to think critically about how ideas of race continue to pervade our lives. I'm race researcher and practitioner Dr. Claire Stewart Hall, and I've studied and researched racism and whiteness and its inhabitants in the institution for many years. In this podcast series, I share key concepts of whiteness and talk about it with others to help myself and listeners develop deeper understanding of how whiteness shapes the worlds we live in. Ultimately, learning more about whiteness helps reduce its invisibility and continues the process of abolishing its dominance over our lives. How do we reduce the power of whiteness? Firstly, we do all we can to notice and question it. So in each episode, I share either a concept, an idea, or talk with other people interested in whiteness and how it works, who share their thoughts on how it shapes our actions, our futures, and our ways of being every day. By listening, we hope that you too can develop awareness and consciousness to transform and reimagine how we live equitably and in solidarity with one another. Hope you enjoy listening. Welcome, everyone. I'm really excited to be on the podcast today because I have with me Professor Denise Miller and Dr. Charmaine Brown, which I'm slightly nervous. I'm not going to lie that they're both here. So I'm going to introduce them both. But both of you, welcome, really welcome, and thank you so much for talking to me.
Thanks for the invitation, Claire. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good. So I'm going to start with Professor Denise Miller, who's Associate Professor of Child and Educational Psychology at the University of Greenwich. Professor Miller taught in primary schools for 8 years. She's a qualified educational psychologist. She holds an MSc in Educational Psychology at University College London. She was an educational psychologist in Lambeth and worked with the needs of marginalised children and those with SEND through assessment, consultation and in-service training. Her PhD is in educational and child psychology, and she works at the School of Human Sciences, and she runs a private practice in educational psychology. She works across early years, primary and secondary, further and higher education settings, and in clinical and legal contexts. She's won various awards, including recently winning the National Teaching Fellow Award. She's also a Principal Fellow for Advance HE, but she's also been nominated for other National Teaching Fellowships in 2023. She won the Poster Prize at the British Education Research Association in 22. She was awarded the ILD Best Output and Best Impact, and she has several nominations for Best Teaching Awards. She sits on various educational boards. She's the editor for Educational and Child Psychology. She's on the advisory board for the Journal of Multicultural Education, and she's the assistant editor at the London Review of Education. She's also held many guest editorships. She's been funded by multiple grants for her research, including from BIRA, the GRE, Innovation Fund, and the ILD, her support funding. Her most recent paper is, and I love this title, I'm Managed by a White Man Who's Managed by a White Man Who's Managed by a White Woman Who's Managed by a White Man, The Problem of Institutional Racism in a UK-based University. So I'm really thrilled to have you here and excited for the conversation ahead. Welcome, Professor Miller.
Thanks, Claire. Looking forward to the conversation.
Great. And I also have Dr. Charmaine Brown, who is just such a brilliant academic. It's amazing to have you here, Dr. Brown. Dr. Brown worked for ILEA, so the Inner London Education Authority, and became education manager at the Peckham Literacy Centre, the Book Place. She's taught in initial teacher education since 2002. She's also an ESOL and literacy specialist, and she holds a professional role as judicial office holder for the Ministry of Justice, sitting on their first tier of Social Security and Child Services tribunals in England, Scotland and Wales, and employment tribunals in England and Wales. She researches themes of professionalisation, and her PhD in 2021 was on the professionalisation agenda in HE, in higher education and further education. But she also researches themes of gentrification and genealogy. She researched FE teachers' attitudes and behaviours in response to professionalisation, and she's also led and been involved in union campaigns, for example, the Fund the Future campaign, Protect Education for All. She's written multiple papers in her own right, but also with Professor Miller, and is listed on paper and managed by a white man who's managed by a white man who's managed by a white woman who's managed by a white man. But also the paper that I just love, and if you haven't read it, please go and read it. It's called The Psychosocial Cost of Racism to White University Staff, which I think is groundbreaking work in the academic field of whiteness and institutional racism. She's a senior lecturer in Faculty of Health and Human Sciences and the Faculty of Education at Greenwich, and she holds external roles for the Society of Education and Training and is a QTLS reviewer. She holds teaching professional qualifications in French, Spanish, ESOL, politics, English, digital literacy, and economics, and has a teaching career in FE that spans 30 years. She facilitates lectures on gentrification of Peckham and black urban removal, for which she's received international recognition. And she's also undertaken and support and has been involved in genetic genealogical research with Jamaican communities and displacement of African diaspora. She's been featured on Radio 4's Thinking Aloud and contributed to the Peckham Heritage Society's publications. She holds huge commitment to community activism alongside her academic excellence and has a lifelong commitment to the empowerment of marginalised communities, providing frameworks to develop innovative practices to enhance community empowerment. She's the early career academic for the School of Education at Greenwich. She is also a fellow for the Society of Education and Training. She has a senior fellowship of Advance HE, and she's the Equality Assessor for the Equality Act for the County Courts. So, Dr. Charmaine Brown, thank you so much for being here. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me, Claire. I'm looking forward to
So with these, I'm with heavyweights, folks. That's what I'm saying. I'm with heavyweights, and I wanted to start really with just asking you, what is whiteness? How do you understand it, and how did you come to know it? So if I ask Dr. Brown, first of all, what is whiteness? How do you understand it?
Well, for me, whiteness is a relatively new term, but the concept has been around for a while or forever. But what is whiteness? Whiteness is where people have an advantage, a severe advantage because of the color of their skin. And they have afforded privileges, which goes with the color of their skin, and they exercise those privileges. That's whiteness in a nutshell for me, based on skin color and also the privileges which go with that, and all the other benefits which go with that skin color.
And Professor Miller?
Similar to what Charmaine just said, really. I think, whiteness, as I understand it, it's less about biology. It's more about ideology. It encompasses a system of power that positions itself as the standard, the norm, the universal. It orders the world in many ways, and it gives privilege to those who are afforded whiteness and renders others, like myself, at a disadvantage. So yeah, similar to what Charmaine said, it's been around for a long, long time, obviously. And I think as I've grown in academia, I've come to realize the power of whiteness more and more. Yeah, sadly.
And can you talk a bit about your, I guess, how you came to know it, and how did it come into your academic writing?
Yeah, I think I came to know about it not through choice, but through necessity, through experience. And I've grown up and worked in institutions that have been predominantly white dominated. And, as I've gone through the universities that I've worked in and academia in particular, as you progress your career, you begin to feel the force of whiteness. You can bury your head and try and imagine it's not there. But for me, that's not part and parcel of who I am. And I think as a result of feeling that and known about it when I was growing up, I grew up in the Windrush era. I was born to parents that were very, they were activists. And so I was very much aware of, what it meant to be a black woman growing up in the UK. I experienced racism from a young age, but in academia, it just feels really entrenched to the point that it propelled me to start writing about it, that it was an outlet for me. And I tend to do things, write about things, or spend time doing things that really resonate. So yeah, you could probably look at my autobiography or know about me by reading my research, I would say. Yeah.
So you're in it. You're.
Yeah, and I'm invested in what I write about. I don't know, I can't do anything that I don't feel, and it has to have that sense of integrity, for me to sustain interest in it, I have to say. Yeah.
And alignment, and I, you know, that sounds like what you're describing is kind of
Yeah,
political and but
very much
also
so.
emotional alignment.
Very much so. It is emotional. I'm glad you said that because my PhD was the title of it was The Silent Catastrophe. And it was about Black British female managers working in children and young people services. And at that time, I was contemplating what's life going to be like for me as a Black British female manager. And so that really started my journey in academia, that my thesis was on that. But then if you look at all the titles of my research, you can see that it aligns with where I am at my career stage or personal development. Yeah.
And Dr. Brown?
Well, how did I come to know it? Well, just by nature of my existence. So I was born in Jamaica, so I was in, at the time of my birth, it was still a British colony, so it was dominated by whiteness. And then I came to the UK as a child, where the impact of whiteness was resounding. So I could say, actually say all my academic journey from primary school was impacted by whiteness and prejudices and discrimination of a level that's still traumatic. So at each stage, I've been through the trauma and being work having to work within a limited standards of the white teachers, the white heads of head teachers and so forth. So by the time I came, yes, it's always been done. Even when I did my master's degree, I did an MSc in education management, and even that was tainted with lots of discrimination. And I think my academic journey, the jobs I've chosen to do, and the communities that I've chosen to work with, is really to try and give them a voice and to empower them to develop, because they also were burdened by whiteness, the student profiles I've encountered over the years. I've had a lot of negative experiences, and I think I'm just finding a middle ground now in how to do. I've dealt with it in different ways, but it always the impact, because there's often no one you can talk to, and even where you have as the level of cognitive dissonance amongst colleagues is very high. So although they will recognize things, they do not want to rock the boat, so to speak, because they're actually benefiting. They'd only talk to you in a very discreet way, making sure no one's around, but they won't do anything positive to try and even to make a difference. So how did I come to know about it? So there's a general fear about aligning yourself with someone who wants to, because I'm an activist in my own right, and because I've got the legal training, and I personally took a race discrimination case against the London Borough of Lewisham in 1998 under the old Race Relations Act, which was a lot more stringent than the Equality Act. Equality Act is kind of a lot fairer in certain aspects. And after going through that case, and that was against whiteness, completely against the whole system, at Lewisham, the chief executive and the education system, and being very successful in that case. But I was really by myself. Denise led me into this research. Denise was a principal person to get me involved in the research, both papers that you quoted. But Denise convinced me there's another way. So that's how I got involved in this particular research.
Wow, thank you.
Yeah.
And I'm hearing so much about the mechanisms that are used. And it's you know, and what's interesting about your work and your positioning is, I don't get the sense that you're using one area. It sounds like your legal work and your knowledge of systems is calibrating the work and being used. How have you found ways of using whiteness or using your knowledge of it? You know, you both bring a lot of knowledge, lived experience of whiteness, but also you've worked in institutions and also you've been in powerful positions in institutions. What do you think about how to kind of the mechanisms to kind of dismantle it or to use it or to use it against itself even?
My approach in the past is always just to go down the legal route because I found talking and finding people that think the same, well, have your sentiments hard is very hard. So I've always used the legal route and I've been very successful. I just take out something against you or the institution. Usually it's the institution I do it on. And as I said, I've had successes. But I think as Denise said, doing the actual putting pen to paper and writing about it, that's another way that I'm merging the two. So it's not just about legislation, it's about documenting and leading on certain research. I'm talking about in the community, I lead on quite a lot of research. And I mean, obviously gentrification is again that's premised on whiteness. The social structure, the political structure that brings about gentrification, and the people that are displaced are often the people in the minority that are displaced because of a discriminatory policy. And it is part of a gentrification is part of policy. So what I'm doing now is it's more about raising awareness and getting other persons involved so we can mobilize. So I'm in groups now with academics, young people, community leaders. I'm doing a more collaborative work and then bringing in my experience in the law and we share experiences. And we're just like I developed a walking tour of the area that I do gentrification in. And at the last walking tour I did, it's academics came, they're always interested, and local people. But what's come off the back of that is that people now want to do research, collaborative research, and to kind of raise awareness, shift the boundaries a bit. So it's a matter of just, for me, it's collaborating, putting more pen to paper, whereas before it was just, I did that, but only in the legal context, because I found that was effective because the law's there. But the satisfaction is not always there. Once you've won the case, what happens next? So it's a mixture of, I mix more the academic and the legal work.
What I'm hearing you say is that research can be a mechanism.
It can be, yeah.
I really like the idea. As an educational practitioner, I needed to do research all the time. I need reflexivity to think about what I'm doing, and actually that can empower me, that can empower us here. That mechanism is available to all of us as a means of critical thought about what you're doing. And so research itself can be a mechanism in different places.
But it has to be meaningful because there's a lot of
Yeah.
research out there that wouldn't inspire me. And even in this area of whiteness, it has to be, it's not just a paper exercise.
Yeah.
It's got to have tangible outputs. It's got to have impact in different circles, not just academia. And for me, just having research that never leaves academia is not always impactful because there's other people out there, because the society is bigger than academia.
Yeah. I've come across my fair share of people. Found myself saying, I actually want to make change. How can it? Because we're not co-creating. We're just writing about co-creation, but we're not actually. We haven't actually spoken to anyone. We've just done lots of literature reviews. That's all we've done. Okay. Professor Miller, you're researching within whiteness. You're researching within a university. What are your thoughts on the mechanisms that can be used to kind of dismantle whiteness or expose it?
Yeah, I mean, how long have you got? Because when you asked the question, I thought, okay, where do I start? I started teaching as a primary school teacher. And I remember doing, when I won the National Teaching Fellow, I had to do an inaugural speech about, winning it and my journey. And I kind of went back to when I trained to be a teacher and the types of things I was doing then with my 4 to 5 year old children through to 11 year old. And even then, I could spot where I was embedding notions about equity, diversity, inclusion, whiteness, if you like, what it means to be a black young person or a black 4 year old in a school that's predominated by white teachers, and really getting the children to celebrate their skin color. I remember doing going to the professional development center and putting on a display where all my children just painted their portraits in all the different shades of black and brown, and then they had to write why they felt they were beautiful. And it was so powerful. It was really moving, actually, that these children really celebrating their skin color, and white children as well. But before that, they were just paint. They didn't put color on their faces for whatever reason. But I wanted them to have that sense of pride, in the color of their skin. So it kind of started from really, really young. I think it's really important. Children at 4 years old are so impressionable. I was the center of their world at that time, being their teacher. I had so much power to change the way that they interacted with black people, what they thought of black people. And I was very much aware of that power, given my own experience of education and how that the power of your words and your interaction, whether they're explicit or nonverbal. How long lasting that can be, because I can remember some of the things that were said to me at my age. When I went into teaching, I was very much aware of that. So I think it started very young, then moved through, then I became an educational psychologist. And like you said, I work with children, young people who have been marginalized for various different reasons, including special educational needs and disabilities. But then there is that, the intersectionality of that as well. If you're black with special educational needs, then you're more likely to have all the adversities thrown at you for whatever reason. So even there, I know I could pinpoint places where I was speaking up in ways that other people were not even reflecting on at that time. And I did write a paper about, I forget the title now. I think it's published by the BERA. I got funding from BERA to publish a paper, but it was all around, the historical beginnings of, black children, young people, being miseducated in the 50s, 60s, 70s, through to the present day, because actually the statistics still bear out that if you're black, in addition to having additional needs, you're going to do far worse in the education system. And in academia, which is not necessarily researched very much at the moment. So yeah, in teaching, I think it's really, really important that teachers are trained in what whiteness means, because if that's embedded into your curriculum and your training, and then you're even assessed on that, some sort of assessment that you're embedding what you know in your training to be a teacher, hopefully then that will, make some sort of dent in what's been going on for decades and hundreds of years. I'm also a big talker. So I will talk and talk and talk, especially if something's bugging me. I always say, I need to talk until it comes out of my body. Something's really impacted me. So this week has been, I've had a really horrible week, to be honest. And I know over the weekend I will talk about it endlessly to whoever comes into my space, until the feeling has left me, because I think it's really unhealthy to hold that within you. And I think research helps me that as well. I'm not, I do research. I'm very mindful that I'm just not doing tokenistic research. I don't just want to put out a paper for the sake of it. I want it to be, like Charmaine said, meaningful, impactful. And I want to really represent the voices of the people that came forward to be participants. That's really important for me, that I'm translating and interpreting what they said honestly, and trying to take my bias out of it, because I come with all kinds of isms and schisms, and biases. And so I go, when we do research, and Charmaine will let you know that we really do unpick the words in great depth before we put it onto the paper, so that we're really confident that we are translating our participants' words truthfully and meaningfully. And we're not using them. We're not just using our participants. They've given up their time is really important. I also recognize that some of the research that I've done, I probably wouldn't be a participant in my research. So when people do come forward, I really am honestly very, very grateful that they do that. But I do know research is not the be all and end all. You know, I think working with children, young people, and now, you know, my students that I work with at the University of Greenwich, it's so important for them to have a role model standing in front of them, you know, shining a light on all the issues that, you know, we're going to discuss today, but doing it in a way that's respectful and valuing different views. You know, I've just submitted a paper on freedom of speech because one of the studies that one of the questionnaires I put out, it came back with surprising results whereby some of my students held quite far right views actually. And I had to really step back and think, oh my gosh, how am I as a lecturer going to really value those people's words, those students' words, and how am I going to have a really intellectual conversation with them where they're challenged, you know, that they have to engage in critical thinking, you know, I might be able to move them on or shift the focus or shift something in them, or it might be that they still hold those views at the end of the session. How do I manage that? So I was grappling with that. It came out in the paper, which hopefully will be published very soon.
And I think the tendency in institutions, just on that point, because I've experienced that just in the last month, that there's a tendency to kind of push it down, to just like shh, shh. One child in a school, he was saying really misogynistic views, and he said, "Oh, I," and the a teacher was asking him about it, and he said, "Oh, my mum says I shouldn't say any of this at school. Like, don't say it here." That's the socialization. That's the learning. Is to just. And also we tend to deal with those things through complaints. And what's interesting about what you're saying is that I would like to go to professional learning that is about, okay, what do we do with it? How do we move children on from those, you know, from those views and those influences all around them at the moment in the UK? And you know, certainly in the glo you know, across the global north. But in universities, what do you see as the way through that at the moment, Denise? That challenge that you said of people having far right views?
To be honest, I don't know the answer to that question because I'm still grappling with the uncomfortability of it myself, you know. But I think what's really important that you are self-reflexive, you know, that you, I was confronted with this and it wasn't something I just buried under the carpet. I know that I want my students, I'm very, you know, probably the thing that I was put on this earth to do was to teach. So I know I'm a very good teacher. So when I became aware of it just took me to a different place whereby I thought, okay, how am I going to manage this in the classroom so that the students at the end of the lecture or the end of the lesson or the end of the academic year, they've moved forward in some shape or form. And it's not necessarily that they're on the same page with me with everything that I believe, because I really don't want to brainwash them into my way of thinking. That would be quite easy, actually. But I want them to have that kind of cognitive shift themselves, whereby actually they've experienced a whole year of me, and it might be something in their thinking that has moved as a result, to a position that is more, helpful living in the society that we are in the UK. But I'm still grappling with it. I think it's education. You know, it's really giving people different perspectives. It's having people in positions of authority and power talking to you so that you're not having purely white academics or leaders or managers, you know, and understanding actually those people are not the stereotypes that you might have grown up with, or having that dissonance as well, you know, experiencing the dissonance of what you truly believe and actually, oh my gosh, this might not be the case. You know, that's a win for me. If you leave thinking something slightly different, that would be a win for me. But I don't know. I don't know. Who knows?
Okay, could I ask you to introduce your paper and what came to it? Maybe if we start with the psychosocial costs of racism to white staff members of an ethnically diverse post-92 university, which was published in the London Review of Education in 2023. I think this is groundbreaking work. It's so clear, and it's free. It's open access, isn't it? So anybody can download it, and I'll put it in the podcast notes. Where did it come from? Why that? Why white staff members? And why the kind of costs? Because I think that's one of the words you use. Two words in there that I think are really key. So one is the cost. You've written about neoliberalism elsewhere, and the performativity and the expected performance within universities, and how that of sometimes, becomes a vehicle or smuggles racism through it. But also the other word that you use, which I think is really important, is you use the word stagnant for whiteness or those cultures in universities.
Well, I can go if you like first, Charmaine. So as Charmaine said, in 2020, we put out a survey. It's an anonymized university, so just to remind everybody. And then we asked people to tell us their views about their experiences of prejudice, discrimination, and racism. And then we also interviewed people as a result, asked them to come forward for individual interviews. There are
Did
three
you
of
just
us.
ask white staff members?
No, black and white staff members. There are three of us. So myself, Charmaine, and Ryan Essex also wrote the paper. We predominantly had more white people coming forward, which surprised us. Yeah, we didn't. In my head, I knew the type of paper I thought I was going to be writing. Yeah. And so when mainly white people came forward, it was a bit surprising because we kind of thought, well, okay, that's going to be interesting, to say the least. But still, I have to say, Claire, that when, as much as I said, you know, when people come forward and they take the time to be interviewed, I know for me, and I can't speak for Charmaine, my bias kind of overrid what they were saying. I was just looking for the paper I planned to write. And I kept going and going with it, and the paper just wasn't coming forward. And all of a sudden, there was a light bulb moment, and I thought, wait a minute, most of our participants are white, and they are telling us about what it means to be white and experience prejudice, discrimination, and racism, you know, being bystanders or witnesses or being in positions of power and feeling powerless to enact any change. And so the focus really shifted from speaking about what it means to be black and experience racism to actually what are the costs for people who are allies, you know, whatever that word means, and who are very uncomfortable of witnessing their black colleagues and friends going through a system that's inherently racist. And then, yeah, we looked for a framework that would fit what our participants were saying. So it was kind of topsy-turvy in that sense. And we found lots of work in the States that would, well, not lots actually, a few theorists were writing about psychosocial costs, which is where we got the framework from. And so it really, in essence, you know, when we went to the BERA conference, we had submitted a plan to write about what it means to be a black person experiencing racism in academia. And so when lots of people turned up to that room, I know I was a bit trembling. I was trembling a bit, thinking they're not going to get what they thought they're going to get. It's going to be somewhat different to what we'd advertised. But
And
thankfully,
just to say that I was in that, for
yeah.
anybody who doesn't know, people were queued down the corridor to come into that
Yes.
room at the British Education Research Conference in 20. There was standing room only. There were literally people squeezed in like sardines to that, to hear you
Yeah.
both speak, just to give the listeners a bit of context. Sorry.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was scary. And I started with a really grounding activity, if I remember rightly, to get people to understand where we're coming from. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. I think people understood what our message was. But the paper, in essence, came as a surprise to us. But the paper we planned to write, it's the second one. You know, I'm managed by a white man who's managed by a white man, yeah, woman and man. So that's the paper we imagined we'd be writing, which came out more recently. But the psychosocial cost of racism is really the one that was a huge surprise to us. It was very uncomfortable for me to write that. I was a little bit scared to be reporting on what it feels like for white people to experience racism. You know, as a black woman, it felt like I was going against the grain of what I should be doing.
That it wasn't your place.
And it wasn't, if I'm honest, I wondered whether that's the story that needed to be told. I mean,
Right.
so what? You
Right, that
know,
is centering whiteness again.
yeah, you know, as a black person, it doesn't touch on what we experience. So why am I pushing this to the fore? So I was really grappling with why I was writing this paper, but I knew it was the right thing to do. But yeah, and it turned out really well, I think. I'll let Charmaine carry on, so.
Yeah, I think I started where Denise ended. I think the way Denise really captured, because I knew she was very uncomfortable about centering whiteness, because the emphasis was what, as she said, what we imagined we'd be leading on, and that was the experience of the black interview participants. But I still think, even with grappling with that unease, Denise really captured it well in writing. I think there was some backlash because there's some people, when they see the title, they automatically think, but why is that an issue? Why are you writing about that? Because I've heard people say, you know, that they were expecting just the second paper to be the one that would be the emphasis of the research. They couldn't see why there was a second part, or there was another side, I should say, which is the views of the white people, why we were giving them airtime. But yeah, that brought a little bit of amongst the our community, because I've heard, you know, and I've introduced it to people, oh, you know, this is the latest paper, or this is the paper. It was kind of like, why do I want to read about that? Whereas the other one with that title was more, the same person would be quicker to want to read that. So it's having to give people explanations of why it was also important to have to represent the view of the other participants. Because they were the other participants in the study. Yeah.
They were the majority
They were
participants.
the majority, yes.
Yeah.
So, but people just think that, you know, I think it, when we was at BERA, there were some really good questions being asked about this study. And I think I was a bit nervous when I saw Vinnie Lander and a few other people I knew who were experts. It's after the end, and Vinnie asked a question, I can't remember what it was. And Deborah Husbands, who were actually experts in the field in the room. So that was a bit unnerving. But I think for me, the process of actually doing all the research with Denise on this bigger study, I think it was really interesting. And it was really, we spent a lot of time on picking, as Denise said, the contribution of participants with our other researcher, Ryan X, Dr. Ryan Essex, who's a quantitative researcher. It was fascinating. Analyzing the transcripts and then actually looking at what was actually said and, you know, how we would represent it. But I remember at the beginning, Claire, I don't know if it was since the recording, you did mention and say about the participant that said, and so it's a conversation which I enjoy having. And I remember you was saying, you know, the word enjoy. But I think you have to look at that quote in the full context. It's because some of the participants, the white participants, this was the first time they felt able to have this conversation. Whether it's to unburden themselves or they thought, you know, I have to say this, I have to make a difference, I have to be part of this journey. But the fact that my impression in sitting on the interviews or conducting some of the leading on some of them was that they were given a space they would never have been given. And I think from what was said, there was a lot that came out of it. A lot came out of it that they just wanted to get off their chest, so to speak. And I think in the climate at the time, with the George Floyd thing still hanging over, and it was in the spirit of the whole research was in the spirit of that. I think it was, yeah. So what the word enjoy, that's what they said, but I would say that they just was glad to have that space.
And I think it's making me, sorry.
Yeah. No, that's all I'm going to say, because if you look at the whole quote, it starts off, I'm very much aware there's a difficulty in people who have experienced discrimination making themselves heard or wanting to speak in the first place. It made me reflect on my own experiences and things which I've been involved with and things which I've witnessed. And so it is a conversation which I enjoy having. From my point of view, it's been hidden for a long time. So I look upon it in the total context of the whole quote.
Yes,
Yeah.
that makes sense. And I was thinking, certainly from my own research, and you know, I interviewed 33 head teachers, senior leaders, assistant heads, and deputy heads in secondary schools in and primary schools in Bristol, and 24 of them identified as white. And there was, you know, similar thing. I was interviewing them in 2022, and lots of white people came forward, partly because there's a real challenge around representation in the city. It resonates with people wanting to have that conversation. The way that I theorized it in my thesis and in my research was that, you know, Zeus Leonardo talks about the idea that white people don't know anything about race. You know, they're not race knowers, or they're innocent of race, or they're ignorant of race. And actually, what that does is it lets white people off the hook, is the way that he describes it. So people don't have to kind of contribute and go, oh, I don't know. I don't know anything about race. And actually, what I love about your piece of work is it shows that white people do know a lot of people not about race. They can
Yeah.
see what's going on. They want to have that conversation. And I guess that it came over really as not to say, or that needs to take up the space, or that's necessarily that those people have all of the answers for it to be dismantled or changed, or to advocate. But I guess for me, what it does is it moves us forward into repositioning the challenge of institutional racism as a problem of white people, and that we don't need to continually have testimony, or that isn't the only way, because at the moment we've got testimony of, and I did this in my own research. I kind of looked at, oh, well, let's look at institutional racism. And then for the last, I mean, I only went back 50 years, but people were saying, have been saying the same thing for 50 years. It's saturated. The data is saturated with racially minoritized leaders and parents and students and teachers saying exactly the same thing. What I like about yours is that your piece and what you're doing is that people need, you know, white people, as W.E.B. Du Bois says, the challenge of institutional racism belongs to white people. Black excellence belongs to black people. You know, to show academic excellence and research, but actually this positioning that race, the idea of race, somehow belongs to global majority people is a fallacy. That actually white people can see what's going on, and it and they're they you know that it and I guess what happens next is in an interesting piece of your paper, because you describe it discomfort, physical discomfort, knots in stomachs, cognitive dissonance, or racial anxiety around having conversations. Did it lead people to advocacy, or did it, because you talk about hopelessness and helplessness that they felt, and a clear kind of need to kind of divest from whiteness, to kind of get out of it. Some people talk about, someone said, participant 17, who's a white woman, said, I don't want to be part of their gang because I don't like what they do. I don't want to negotiate on my value set, particularly around race. And I guess it's indirectly affected me in that sense. I'm not prepared to join in their tacit club. So did you have a sense of, you know, obviously there are toxic and harmful environments that they were working in. What did they do with it? Because white people are in positions of authority, that can
Yeah.
make change, and it won't change, as Vinnie Lander says, the people who need to dismantle whiteness are white people. It will only shift when the majority moves. Do you have any thoughts on that, Denise?
I mean, and that was the point of the paper, really, because we were saying, actually, like you said, Claire, you can go back decades and decades, and the research is already saying to you, black people experience institutional racism. It's ongoing. It's inherent. It's pervasive. It's harmful. We know that. And as much as we thought we were going to churn out another paper saying something similar, this paper kind of shifted the narrative a bit to say, white people are in positions of power and authority invariably, and we are not necessarily sitting around the table that make all the decisions about us. So we have to just flip the switch, if you like, to look at this and say, actually, this isn't our problem. The problem is actually the people sitting around the decision-making tables, making the biased decisions. And if there are people that are within those meetings or committees or, in positions of power that understand and have witnessed it and are uncomfortable and are prepared to speak up about it in the way that our participants did, then we need to actually raise the profile of their plight. And could this be a different way of tackling institutional racism that's not been done before? So we were being a bit strategic or a bit clever, if you like, because we're still talking about, in essence, the same thing. And in the paper, and I've done an interview for The Voice, for example, and I had to make it painfully clear that I'm not saying that white people experience racism in the same way that black people do. They cannot. But what I'm saying is that we are not in a position whereby we can actually manage to dismantle this. We can't. We're just not there yet. And could it be by sympathizing with white people about how they experience racism and bringing that to the fore and discussing that in the way that we did in the paper, that might make a change or shift the narrative a bit. In reality, though, and maybe I'm just feeling a bit pessimistic this week because I've had a hard week, I'm not sure that much has changed. The status quo remains the same. It hasn't really shifted. We're in 2025, we're talking about the same issues that we did in 2020. Nothing's changed for me necessarily. I see that I've experienced racism this week, which for me was very explicit. But like Charmaine said earlier on, I would not go and report it anywhere because there's no trust. And who am I reporting it to? People that don't look like me. So nothing's really changed. It just goes round and round and round. And so, I'm coming to probably, the last decade of my career in academia and thinking I'm not sure anything's going to change in my lifetime is the honest truth. Because there has to be a will to change and there has to be that cognitive attitudinal shift from the powers to be at the top all the way to filter through to the bottom. And I don't know that that's there because it, especially in this day and age, it's survival of the fittest. You want to survive. You want your children to survive. And then it just goes, the cycle just continues. That's the way I'm looking at it today. Maybe talk to me next week, it might be different. But I just don't feel anything has shifted as a result of any of the papers that I've written. I think people understand a bit more, and it might have changed a few people's minds or made a difference in some people's lives. I do think it's important, though, to document it because this is the truth. But in terms of getting rid of racism, I don't know that it's made a dent in that at all. Yeah.
And do you have any thoughts on that, Charmaine?
Well, Denise has said a lot which resonates with how I feel, but I also would like to add that I think the papers, all those things haven't changed, and we're still at the same position 2025, and there's not enough Black people in, at the decision seat at the decision-making table to effect change. But I do feel that the papers have generated an interest and maybe encouraged or helped people to develop their own kind of strategic way they're going to deal with, or they're going to raise the issues that we've raised in our papers. Because at conferences, they're always welcome, these discussions. And I've seen since we started on this journey, we've been to quite a few conferences, and it's always a point of interest. And even I'll give an example. We went to Cyprus, University of Cyprus last year. It was a psychology conference, European Psychology Conference. And even at the conference, I mean, I stayed at the hotel I was in. I didn't realize some of the conference delegates were there. But some of them, they decided they wanted to have breakfast, and they were having discussions on how they would try and apply some of these principles in the countries where they're from, where it was a different approach. Because one of the people that I spoke to, she said she works with traveling communities in a European country, and she'd like to kind of adopt this approach and look at how she can move. So put it this way, the story, not the story, the approach, or the it's had an impact. Even though I'm tired, Denise expressed how she's tired because things are still happening. But I think we don't appreciate the impact that we've had. I mean, that BIRA conference 2023 was a shift, because I remember 2024, me and Denise was in the lift. Was it Man in Manchester? And the lady was in the lift and was talking about the 2023 conference. We couldn't remember who it was, but she was obviously in the room. And she was saying, you know, so I think other people, and I've heard the term, the psychosocial cost of racism, since used in other contexts. And I believe, and in discussions I've had with Denise, it stems from this research. So it is going out there. Whether or not it's going to make a change to what's really happening in society is another matter. But the conversations are being had, and it shifted from the conversation of which was more critical race theory. So this psychosocial cost is a term I'm hearing now. I never heard it before we did our research. Obviously, it was in America, that's where it came from. But in the UK, I never heard that term being used in a way, but I'm now hearing, I've heard it since. Yeah, so yeah.
You never know the impacts, do you? I'm thinking about those children whose portrait they created, and you don't know the impacts, do you? Because when I work with people around race identity coaching, sometimes I go back, I'm in the work that I do with Viv Grant, we go back to people's socialized experiences. You don't know the impact that you're having on somebody's race identity or somebody's socialization until much later on. And I think also as a researcher, I know when I came across this, it was like affirmative. It was like keep going. Like this is, it's like a, it was like I said before the call, it was like a port in a storm listening to that lecture and reading this piece. So, and I can almost trace them back. When you're doing your literature review for your thesis, you kind of trace it back and trace it back and trace it back. Oh, like they were talking about it in 1967. They talked about the exact same thing. It's different language, but it's the same thing that they're talking about. So it's almost like breadcrumbs. I just wanted to talk about one more thing just before we close, which is about and in your second paper, I'm managed by a white man. Who's managed by a white man, who's managed by a white woman, who's managed by a white man, the problem of institutional racism in a UK-based university. In terms of methodology, you use the Brawn and Clark's 2006 thematic analysis and you integrate it with critical race theory. It's a beautifully laid out for anybody who hasn't read this 2025 paper. But why, can you tell me a bit about methodologies for talking about whiteness and writing about it and what you've learned so far? Why did you decide to integrate CRT into Brawn and Clark's thematic analysis, which is widely used all over the world, isn't it?
It just fell short. It just didn't hit the nail on the head for me when we were looking at it, and we wanted the correct language and the correct lens through which to interpret our participants' words. So I'm quite pragmatic in my approach. I'm not precious about one particular approach over another. If it works for me and it fits well and it seems to fulfill my brief for integrity, then yeah, that's what I went with. And thankfully, I think it kind of merged and integrated to a good analysis. Yeah, I was quite proud of that.
And I think it's really cool. It would be so helpful for people who are thinking about race and methodology. There was also something around the kind of aspects of CRT, specifically around colour blindness and colour evasion, that I thought was significant. And I guess it highlighted the kind of colour evasion of Brawn and Clark's frame. That it didn't include the kind of race within it, but I really like that. So if you're a researcher listening to this and you haven't looked at that methodology, I think it's really important. And there's something about the way that Charmaine and Denise and Ryan write that it's so clear, it's so well structured and so well kind of laid out and clear. So I want to end really with just asking, what do you know, one of your participants in the earlier psychosocial paper says that, you know, we need to explode it, we need to blow we need to start again. So what do we do with whiteness? What's the do you have any thoughts really on what do we do about it? Can it be reconstructed, or do you think we abolish it?
For me, it's important to really name whiteness where it hides, you know, to really in with whether it's within our policies, in our practices, you know, who gets to manage, who gets to lead, who gets promoted. I think it's really important about discussing, you know, shifting power dynamics as well, and not just inviting different people to the table, but rebuilding and restructuring the table altogether so that people feel included within that table. Because there are so many different subtleties around that table that exclude people. And within one of the papers we write about, you know, there's always that people always talk about going down the pub for some reason. It just really is quite significant to a lot of people who are racially minoritized, that the notion of socializing in areas where they feel uncomfortable is really that really comes to the fore in the interviews. And we know that lots of decisions are made in those places, like really important conversations are being had, but because we're not there, we're excluded. So it's about working strategically and knowing that people who hold the positions of power, they don't necessarily look like me and Charmaine. And understanding that, and then working with them to really want to dismantle it. Yeah. And not be fearful of dismantling it and including more people that look similar to themselves. There's still lots and lots of work to be done. I'm optimistic that things are shifting. It does feel like we take some steps back, you know, especially if you're, you know, the politics that abound at the
This
moment.
week, yes,
Yeah,
yeah.
exactly. You know, my son's only 15 years old, and I always had that as my litmus test. You know, by the time he's my age, will things have changed? And sometimes I think, not sure. But I hope so. I hope so. I hope he's not having the same conversation that I've been having today, you know, 30 years' time.
And Charmaine?
Yeah, I think Denise captured it perfectly in what she said. I would like to add, however, that in order to try and assist a shift in affecting change, I think minoritized people really have to look at the impact on, like, health, for example, because it takes a lot more. I think because we're in that position where we have to try and, it doesn't matter how strategic we are, we have to try and not convince us, but trying to show someone or showing a group of people how things impact, and them not understanding it in the same way is very it's tiring, it's traumatizing, and it really does have a health impact. And I think I should say that if I remember with the first I'm managed by a white man, the black participants in that study, they did indicate how they were affected. And I think when we look at academia as a whole, it does take a lot out of you if you're trying, even on a small level, even the departmental level, if you're in a meeting and you're trying to put a point across to minimize the impact of racism on your student population, for example, in my department, no one else gets it. And you can really try and be as put all the data out, all the evidence is there, but people don't see things the same way. And I take on board the point Denise made about the pub where the decisions are made. I'm guilty of when it comes, when we're at conferences, when we're at certain, I'm at certain events, academic events with colleagues, and the pub is mentioned. I usually avoid it. And I'm trying to change that mindset, but when the odd times I do go, I make an early exit because it's not my kind of environment. And you're guaranteed the next day you hear all the decisions that were made after you'd left, because it's a time people stay in the pub is where things really take off. You know, it's like you have to be thrown out at closing time. I'd never stay in the pub, even if I go. It's like within a short space of time, I'm in the mind. It's to be sociable. But really, that's not when decisions are made. It's when everybody's legless. Yeah. And I hear all the stories. And that's been a funny thing that I've always reflected on when I've been to workplace events. So, yeah, I won't have a seat at the table because I'll even if I'm at the table, I won't be there long enough to be party to that conversation and change. Yeah.
And I suppose it's such a good example of how inaccessible conversations are and inaccessible spaces are for people, and what is centered in those spaces, the kind of social that is centered, the kind of social interaction that's prioritized or centered, or the things you're not expected to say in a, you're not really expected to disagree in a pub, are you? Or you're meant to resolve it really quickly. You're meant to kind of tune in to the environment, and all sorts of things happen in pubs, violence. But it's such a good example of how it's positioned as a kind of neutral space that people perceive, if you're white middle class person or white working class person, you might perceive that as a neutral space, or it's framed or positioned in that way when it just isn't. And the
Yeah.
thought, the thought that, can you imagine black-led organisations saying we're just going to nip to the pub and make decisions about budget? Can you imagine how that would be framed on the front page of the newspaper? And yet that happens all the time across different sectors. So that, thank you for that example, because it's a really good one. I wonder what it is that will make a difference to white people changing their behaviour. I say this as a white woman. What's the kind of belief, what's the that we present enough data and that enough data is presented that white people go, oh, I see, institutional racism happens like this, I'll then change. We can see as whiteness is recentering at the moment, politically, legally, institutionally, people are kind of saying, oh, we're going to cancel our EDI work, we don't really need to do it. So we can see how whiteness recenters. But I've been thinking on this podcast is about what does whiteness hate? What does whiteness really, really not like? What really cuts its legs out? And one of the things that I think I've learned so far in doing this podcast is that whiteness hates organizing. Whiteness hates collectives organizing, and really hates any power being shifted without it. Is it like whiteness likes us to use whiteness to advance particular groups? But actually, if it doesn't use whiteness, if it doesn't use those same systems and methods, it's highly problematic because it can't get to it. And I wondered, just as a final question, really, before we close, what do you think whiteness hates? Do you have any thoughts on that? What is it not like? What works well against it?
I'll let you go, Charmaine.
I think having it has to be in control. It has to be the leader in whatever situation. It's like I've been in meetings where I will say something, or somebody that looks like me will say something, and somebody who's white will say the same thing, but the second or third statement, which is just a repetition, is the one that's celebrated and brought to the fore of the meeting and opens up, and that person or persons, you know, they're given the credit. And it's as if as if we're in different meetings. Is that a deliberate attempt to block out certain sections of social group? Is that a deliberate? I always wonder. So yeah, they have to be centered first and be the lead. And where they're not centered originally, they make themselves the center. So that's what they don't like, being a participatory or being part of something that's already been created.
Totally. Yeah. That is such a good observation. Thank you. That is a brilliant observation. Professor Miller?
I would say whiteness hates giving up power and control. Whiteness hates feeling vulnerable. You know, I'm thinking what it feels like for me. You know, whiteness hates being made to feel in the minority. I would say whiteness hates being found out to not be doing what you're saying you're doing. Yeah. And I think whiteness probably hates the notion of being led by blackness. And I think, you know, one of the goals for me, and it's fundamental, you know, it's basic, and through my research and my work, is not, you know, hopefully one day, like I said, when my son's in my position, he's not having to explain to white people what institutional racism is. Simple. There's no need for our research anymore, because we've shifted from this basic position of the cycle just going round and round in a rabbit's, the hamster's wheel. So yeah, I think that's what I think about whiteness. I could add more and more, but that's it in a nutshell.
And Could I just add,
I'm just going back to the study, the psychosocial cost of racism, and the Exum study in 2022, where he had the medical experiment where he said to, he told the research participants that they have to do a role reversal. In other words, the white students, there was a medical error and they so-called became black. And what the anxiety that and everything else it caused them, it's only a fictional study, but that's whiteness in a nutshell. The thought that something could accidentally change your position is, you know, alarming for them, whereas for us it's the norm, how we are and how we find ourselves. But that medical experiment, I thought it was very interesting, that Exum one in 2022, which is cited in the, in the paper.
In the paper. I'll put those in the notes so that people can read it. That sounds like a brilliant place to end. Thank you both so much for talking on this podcast. And I know that listeners will really, really benefit from what you've said. Thank you, everyone. And we'll see you in the next podcast.